from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis talked about genocide, Brexit, and apologies during his in-flight interview last Sunday. This week on Register Radio, Jeanette DeMello and Edward Penton, who accompanied the Holy Father to Armenia, discussed the trip and what exactly the Pope said. Also, Jeanette and author Mary Eberstadt look at secularism's growing intolerance for Christianity. Welcome again to Register Radio, a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. Thanks so much for joining us. Our first guest today, Edward Penton, is the Rome correspondent for the National Catholic Register. Edward has also reported on the Holy See and the Catholic Church for Newsmax, Zenit, the Catholic Herald, and the Holy Land Review. Today, Edward talks with Jeanette about the Holy Father's trip to Armenia last week.
Edward, it's great to have you back on Register Radio. You had an exciting weekend last weekend. You were a part of the press corps that accompanied Pope Francis to Armenia June 24th through the 26th. What were the highlights of that trip?
Well, it was mainly ecumenical, Jeanette. It was really to draw the Apostolic Armenian Church and the Catholic Church together. That was the key aspect of it. The Apostolic Armenian Church is not actually that far away from the Catholic Church. In fact, it's sort of described as half Orthodox and half Catholic. So there's already a certain basis of good relations there. And the Catholicos, the head of the Armenian Apostolic Church, was side by side with the Pope on almost every event. So that sort of underlined the closeness of the relations. But there were lots of different things going on, lots of highlights, really. And I think from the ecumenical perspective, there was the Divine Liturgy on the Sunday, which had the Pope attended as well. That was quite unusual to have the Pope praying at the Divine Liturgy on the Sunday. Of course, he couldn't receive communion, but it was a key aspect of it. And Father Federico Lombardi, the Vatican spokesman, said it was the top highlight for him, because it really did show how close they were. And it talked about, the Pope talked about opening a new phase of ecumenical relations there. But there were also others too. There was the meeting at the Corvirat Monastery, which is a very famous monastery in Armenia. It's where Gregory the Illuminator converted the king of Armenia, making it the first Christian state in the world back in the 4th century. And the two leaders met there and released a couple of doves to denote the desire for peace. And then there was a joint declaration also signed that day on the final day, which was also another highlight. And one of the highlights, well, I wouldn't call it the highlight, but certainly a controversy, was the Pope's mention of the word genocide.
That's right.
In a speech unexpectedly, which we can go on to talk about later. But that was also a key aspect of this visit. And then, of course, the Pope's comments on the papal plane, which always draw a lot of media attention.
Absolutely, and we'll get to that in just a moment. You know, Edward, this was your first trip on the papal plane with the Holy Father, so you were very close to him throughout this whole trip. What was the difference for you in covering the Pope in this way?
Yeah, it was certainly different. One's obviously with the Pope a lot more, and you get to see him close up. I actually managed to get to ask him a question this time. Usually the journalists coming back on the papal plane get to ask him different questions, so that was a highlight as well. And I think it was a very interesting way of traveling with him, because you do follow him around, and you get to see close up sort of how things are done, and how more closely, how especially on this visit, how he was very close to the Catholicos, Karekin II, and really there was a certain chemistry between them, and a certain, you know, very good rapport that they had. And so you get to see all by being so much closer to the action, really. So it was good in that way.
Yes, it was very great. It was great to see you on Twitter and all of the photos that you were sending on Facebook and Twitter and all of our social media. It was really the photos really captured that closeness that you speak of between the Catholicos and the Pope, and so we appreciate that kind of visual. Now let's turn for a second to the use of the word genocide. It wasn't in the speech, but the Pope chose to say it anyway. Edward, can you tell us the ramifications of the use of the word genocide?
Sure, yes. Well, the Pope used the word unexpectedly in his speech. He wasn't going to mention it. It wasn't written down. It was made to the president and civic authorities and diplomats on the first evening of his visit. But I think he used it because he felt it wouldn't... although he said it did cause offense, he never meant it to cause offense. But he always used that word when he was in Buenos Aires with the Armenian community. He used the word genocide, and he felt happy using it this time. He thinks of it as one of the three genocides of the early 20th century, the other ones being the Nazi genocide and the Soviet Union one. And so I think that he felt perfectly justified to use it, although
sure.
We really weren't expecting him to do so. But of course, the Turkish authorities find this very offensive. Those killed is exaggerated. They also say that Turks were involved, and they were also victims of it. And so they resent this use of this word and the blame being put on Ottoman Turks.
Sure.
So it led to a minister in Turkey saying the comments were very unfortunate and that the Pope shouldn't use what he called a crusader's mentality. And he felt it was obviously prejudiced against the Turkish authorities. But I think I don't think it had too much of an effect. Pope Francis has a very clever way and interesting way of kind of neutralizing certain problematic things that he might say. And partly, I think, because he is so popular around the world, that things that he might say don't rub people up the wrong way as perhaps some of his predecessors said them.
Sure, sure. This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to our Rome correspondent, Edward Penton, who traveled with Pope Francis last weekend to Armenia. Edward, during that trip, on the way home, in fact, on the flight, on the way there and on the way home, Pope Francis mentioned Brexit. This is the British leaving the EU. This was very, very noteworthy, newsworthy event of the week before, and it dominated the news cycle. What did the Pope have to say, and how is it relevant to what's happening?
Yes, well, he mentioned it twice. In fact, he mentioned it going out, and he mentioned it coming back from Armenia. Going out, he said it was clearly a sign of the will of the people that they wanted to leave the European Union. But he also called on the authorities in Europe and in the UK to exercise great responsibility to make sure that that there is peaceful coexistence in the transition from being a member of the European Union to being outside of it. And then on the way back, I asked him on behalf of the Register, whether he thought it could perhaps lead to the disintegration of the EU. But he said that... he didn't really answer the question, but he did say that there is a need for a new form of union. He talked about the need for a healthy disunity. So in other words, probably sort of referring to subsidiarity, where certain decisions should be left to the local governments rather than to a centralized authority. So he's kind of supportive in that way of the decision, but at the same time, he said that they shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater,
right.
And one should try to sort of redeem and recreate the essence of the European Union without being too excessive, I think was his general point. But it was hard to pin him down exactly how he felt about it. I think partly because, as he admitted twice in his response, he didn't really know. It's not really his speciality, but I think what he's concerned about and what he said before is that Europe is declining, it's losing its vitality, and it needs to regenerate and find ways of really recalling its Christian roots and bringing back the gospel into the continent and revitalizing itself and becoming dynamic again. And I think he sees this as possibly a way forward, but at the same time, I think he also can see the dangers as well of it.
Yes, Edward, you know, you did so much coverage during this trip of the Pope's flight after. You had a few videos. We didn't get a chance to talk about some of the questions and answers that happened on that flight. So I want to refer our listeners to your blog, Edward Penton. If they just clicked on your name on our website, they would get the list of your blogs, and that's where the Pope talks about apologizing to people who are gay and to many others who have been discriminated against. He also touches on Pope Benedict's anniversary of his priesthood and how supportive it is to have Pope Benedict praying for him throughout his papacy. And Edward, I just want to let you know how much we appreciate your coverage and we look forward to having you on again.
Okay, thanks, Jeanette.
When we return, why are some people who are quick to accuse Christians of intolerance so intolerant? This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More in a moment.
Bishop Robert Barron talks about the importance of the National Catholic Register.
You know, the Register delivers something which is extremely important because you won't get it from the mainstream media, namely the Catholic context and perspective. Sometimes the mainstream media will pretend, oh, they don't have a perspective. They're just giving the news neutrally. Well, no one does that. Everyone's got a perspective. What they often bring is a sort of secularist ideology. The National Catholic Register brings a robustly Catholic take on the world, and that's indispensably important.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DiMello, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Mary Eberstadt, is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mary has written widely for magazines and newspapers, among them First Things, Policy Review, The Weekly Standard, The Wall Street Journal, and Commentary. Mary talks with Jeanette today about secularism's growing intolerance for Christianity.
Mary, it's so great to have you on Register Radio. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeanette.
You know, as we approach the 4th of July and we near the end of the Fortnight for Freedom, which is the U.S. Bishop's 2-week-long celebration of religious liberty, you have written in many places around the Internet about the challenges we face to that freedom. In your view, what's the most formidable threat that you see?
Well, I think there are threats on a variety of levels, and I'm not being alarmist here, mm-hmm. but it is important to emphasize that religious freedom in this country cannot be taken for granted. I know that comes as a shocking proposition to mm-hmm. many people, but when you look around America today, you see concerted attacks against Christianity, particularly traditional-minded Christianity. On a number of levels, you see anecdotes. There are many stories by now of people who have lost their jobs or been socially penalized for things like giving a student a Bible or mm-hmm. otherwise falling afoul of current secularist progressivism. The fire chief in Atlanta who was fired for publishing a book about his traditional Christian beliefs. There are lots of individual anecdotes like that, Jeanette, but underneath them is a much wider systematic attack on Christian institutions. For example, Catholic and other charities are under siege mm-hmm. by progressive activists who do things like sue the U.S. bishops at the southern border of the United States because Catholic work there with refugees doesn't include abortion and contraception. And you see this in the case of crisis pregnancy centers, too, which are sued, again, by activists, or they are burdened with difficult ordinances to make their work harder. Now, what do they do? Well, they give free sonograms and material aid and support to women who are often desperate, women who want to keep their babies. So the point is that no matter what the humanitarian intent is of these charities, there are people out there who want to shut this stuff down because it is Christian.
Right.
And if that's not a problem for religious freedom, it's hard to see what would be.
Right, exactly. And really, what you're referring to right there is covered in a chapter of your book, your new book that is out this month. It's Dangerous to Believe, Religious Freedom and Its Enemies. It was published by HarperCollins. Unfortunately, I haven't had the chance to read that book yet. Joan Frawley Desmond, one of our staff writers, is in the midst of it right now and will soon be reporting on it. But this is a chapter of your book that deals with the attack on these charitable institutions, particularly places like Catholic Charities. I look forward to delving into that more. But I want to turn to a column that you recently wrote for the Register. It talks of a secularist witch hunt. And it's an interesting choice of words to call this a witch hunt. How is it a witch hunt today?
There's something deeply irrational about the pursuit of religious believers by radical secularists. This is not to say that everybody who's outside religious circles wants to be part of this pursuit. I don't think that's true, Jeanette. Mm-hmm. In fact, part of the reason I wrote the book is that I want to both encourage the believers out there that we can turn this thing around, but also to talk to people on the left and say, look what is being done in the name of your movement. Look at what your runaway activists are doing to penalize Christians in the public square these days.
So I enjoyed this column a lot, and obviously it goes back to the idea, or I guess the actual fact that in the early days of our country, the colonization of our country, there were these actual witch hunts. It is happening today, and some of the examples that you mentioned just previous were, you know, related to Catholic Charities, but it's happening in a big way related to schools around the country. And I wanted to talk about that for a minute. You wrote a column for the Federalist that really delved into this particular problem on campuses, and that interests our listeners a lot because obviously the university and college campuses is a place of forming people, and yet Christians are being driven out of that. Can you speak to some of those examples?
Yes, and I share the concern of people who are worried about that. So Christian groups like InterVarsity, which is a Protestant evangelical group, have been kicked off some secular campuses for not opening their leadership to non-Christians. Now just think about that for a minute. I mean, who goes and tells a vegetarian student group that they have
right.
to be headed by carnivores, right? I mean, that doesn't happen, but there is something about an exception that's made for Christianity. There are Christian student groups of other kinds, and I list them in that article, that have also come into trouble. There's also the fact that during the past 10 years, there have been attacks on the accreditation of two Christian schools, both of them Protestant evangelical, one King's College in New York and the other Gordon College in Massachusetts. And in both cases, the schools were able to repel these attacks, but this is very worrisome, Jeanette, because if schools like that can be attacked, so can Catholic schools, and nothing could be more inimical to religious liberty than the idea that you can't even create a university founded on Christian principles without it coming under attack. That is deeply concerning. So again, the reason why I put all this stuff into the book was not to deliver a Jeremiah about it, mm-hmm. but instead to try and do something positive and say, look, this is the record that is being assembled by radical secularist activists today. This is what they're doing to Christians, and not only in the United States. I also throw in examples from other countries. And I think we're at a real turning point with this stuff, that we either return to a more tolerant, magnanimous society where we agree to disagree,
right.
or everything gets worse and religious liberty becomes something that's more like a relic than right. a living standard for this country.
This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Mary Eberstadt, who recently wrote the book It's Dangerous to Believe, Religious Freedom and Its Enemies. Mary, you just said something that was, I think, very profound, and that is, where are we going next? You know, how do we actually do something to stop this very negative trend towards intolerance? And it's really, it's something I'm sure that burns in the minds of many, many people, many Catholics, many Christians. How do we stop this? I mean, because when we speak out, we are labeled as haters or bigots when we try to defend the church's teaching on many different topics. So what do we do?
Well, I think the first thing to do, Jeanette, is to not be scared. I think part of the problem is that there has been self-censorship of a certain kind because of what you described, because people are afraid to stand up. We need to get over that. Mm-hmm. We need to remember that when Christianity is attacked, so are all the people who depend on the churches. So if it helps to give us a little more backbone, we need to remember that the victims of sex trafficking and desperate single mothers and refugees and homeless people and so many other people rely on our charitable networks. So we can't stand down without standing down on their account, if you see what I mean.
Right.
So that's the first thing. And then the other thing is, I think we just need to use some of the moral ammunition that's already lying around. And what I mean by that is we can be a lot more proactive in pressing the case that people should stop trying to litigate our charities out of existence.
Mm-hmm.
This is a humanitarian issue. I think we can turn the tables on this discussion by saying that if we were talking about anything else but Christianity, the idea that there are people who wake up in the morning and try to shut down other people's charities, other people's good works, would seem crazy.
Right.
I mean, even a six-year-old would say, you can't do that. That's mean. Well, mean is what's going on all over the nation right now in these attacks on Christian charities. So that's a place where I think we can take a very solid stand in the name of the people who need the churches.
That's right. You know, Mary, this is the week, 2 weeks of celebrating freedom. During these 2 weeks around the country, relics of St. John Fisher and St. Thomas More have been passing around the country in different places. I'm here in Denver, and I was able to venerate these relics this week. And this reminds us, as did Archbishop Laurie, as he led off this time of celebration and reflection, this is a time to reflect on the suffering that often comes for the sake of the gospel in greater or lesser ways. And perhaps right now in our country, we're experiencing this suffering in a let's say milder way, but it could get worse. And I do think and encourage our listeners to take heart by your words and to gain some courage in speaking and defending what we know to be true, especially in our charitable works. I encourage our listeners to read your column at the Register online at ncregister.com. The Trouble with Secularist Witch Hunts is the title. And Mary, thank you so much for being with us today, and I do hope your book is very widely read.
Oh, thank you, Jeanette. I'm wishing everybody a happy 4th.
Absolutely. Same to you. Happy 4th of July.
Don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com or ewtnradio.net. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio. For our producer, Elena Rodriguez, Jeanette, and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.